Aaron, it's good to have you join your dad and your hubby and spending some time with us. I trust all of you have got your outline. Those were handed out there. Joe will pass them around if you need to put your hand in. He'll make sure you get it. Do you need the lectern or anything? You just hold it. That's fine. All right. Yeah, there you go. Just love to just... Well, that's all right. They'll share. Couples will share. Others will share. Multiply the leaves of paper. Just love getting to know you a little bit better here, Aaron. What's your story? The silliest costume you ever worn was?
Maybe the silliest or the geekiest. When I was in grad school, we were learning all about... ethnic and racial studies, and I remember my fellow grad student friend and I, we were living together in an apartment, and we dressed up as the ghosts of white privilege, which was terribly geeky and ridiculous, and nobody else got it, but we just tried to look like ghosts, but with a Caucasian look. I don't even know. It's so ridiculous.
There. We need to pray for you. God, we just thank you so much for just this privilege that we have of just being under the instruction of your word. And Lord, even as I think it was Mark that reminded us of just having that those two volumes that we look at when we think about how we can intersect culture and scripture. And Lord, we just pray that as Aaron speaks this afternoon, that you would open up our hearts to receive what your Spirit wants to teach us and your church in this day. Lord, bless her, give her strength as she talks, and us, Lord, as we... it's been a long day for us, and many of us have heard a lot of content, but Lord, we just love receiving from you, and just give us ears to hear, and above all, hearts to respond to wherever you're leading, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Yeah, I have to say thanks so much for coming back at 4 o'clock. Mala is flaked out on the bed, and I think probably some of you were leaning in that direction as well. So thanks for being here. I just want to open with a quote here that I've got on the top of the page, if you have a page. If not, you can listen or look in on somebody else's. It's not a full outline, but just a few thoughts on the handout. Welcome is one of the signs that a community is alive. To invite others to live with us is a sign that we aren't afraid, that we have a treasure of truth and of peace to share. A community which refuses to welcome, whether through fear, weariness, insecurity, a desire to cling to comfort, or just because it's fed up with visitors, is dying spiritually. This is a quote by Tim Dickow, who pastors in East Vancouver and is a friend of ours, a book that he wrote about his community and how they tried to become a radically welcoming community. I think in our culture, control and self-sufficiency are the signs often of strength, the markers of strength. And this quote, I think, speaks to this ability to welcome as being a strength. A sign of spiritual vitality, in fact. And I just want to open with the question of whether our churches are being those kinds of spiritually vital, welcoming places, whether our churches reflect the diversity of our neighborhoods and look as if they have been welcoming, whether they're a place that welcome people of many different, of large diversity, in all the different areas, in terms of age, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of social strata, all those different kinds of diversities that we can have in our communities. And I know we've changed around the talks, but this is the talk in which we'll talk about refugees and the prophetic hospitality of the church. It's refuges, I think, on one of the pieces of program, but that works just as well for me. I want to just offer something of a challenge and maybe encouragement towards practicing hospitality, prophetic hospitality in churches. And I'm going to give some emphasis throughout to refugee welcome, but mostly I'll just leave that till the end, in just a few minutes at the end, just think about how we can apply it in that area. So first, just introducing the tradition of hospitality, and then exploring some of the contemporary connotations that come along with hospitality, and asking in contrast what a prophetic hospitality might look like, and then moving to the question of how does this biblical call to hospitality apply to refugee welcome, and what do we do to nourish this prophetic hospitality in our communities. So first, hospitality as a Christian tradition, it's has a really rich and long history in Christian traditions across the board. If you want to delve into it deeply, a good person to go to is Christine Pohl, P-O-H-L, who's written a book called Making Room. And she does both a theological and historical exploration of the concept and the practice of hospitality in Christian traditions. We heard this morning about Israel as a community of hospitality. Move forward a few centuries. In the 5th century, we have Saint Benedict, who insisted that hospitality maintains a prominence in the living Christian tradition. The guest represents Christ and has a claim on the welcome and care of the community. One of the Benedictine rules was that all guests who present themselves are to be welcomed as Christ. All guests who welcome themselves are to be welcomed as Christ, or present themselves are to be welcomed as Christ. Move forward a little bit. We've got John Calvin, who writes out a series of objections to hospitality that we may have. He says, "Therefore, whatever man you meet who needs your aid, you have no reason to refuse to help him." You have no reason to refuse to help him. You could say, "He is a stranger, but the Lord has given him a mark that ought to be familiar to you by virtue of the fact that he forbids you to despise your own flesh," 1 Samuel 58:7. So you may say, "Well, he's a stranger, but you should recognize him. He's your own flesh." You might say, "But he's contemptible and worthless. But the Lord shows him to be the one to whom he has deigned to give the beauty of his image. If God is to give him his image, and he is worthy enough of that, how can you say he's not worthy of your hospitality?" You might say that you owe nothing for any service of his, but God, as it were, has put him in his own place in order that you may recognize toward him the many and great benefits with which God has bound you to himself. The language is old and convoluted there. But basically, you might say you don't owe him anything, but God has put him there, and you owe so much to God. And it's out of what you owe to God that you give to others, that you offer this hospitality. You might say, this is the last pushback against hospitality, that he does not deserve even your least effort for his sake. But the image of God, again, the image of God, which recommends him to you, is worthy of giving yourself and all your possessions. So Saint Benedict speaks about Christ being the guest. The guest is Christ. And John Calvin talks about the image of God in the guest that calls us to host and to be hospitable, to welcome. And then let's go to Abraham Kuyper. He writes about two kinds of households. He says, on the one side, we have a household that is full of self-sufficiency, that affects you coldly and uncomfortably, sometimes exhaling the odor of selfishness. I find it so interesting that he mentions selfishness, but it's not selfishness that stands in opposition to hospitality. It's self-sufficiency. So hospitality is the opposite of self-sufficiency, and that sounds counterintuitive to me, because sometimes you feel you need to be self-sufficient in order to host and be hospitable. But there's something about hosting and being hospitable that actually makes you dependent on another person, and we'll explore this a little bit more later. So this is the one kind of household: self-sufficient, cold, uncomfortable, sometimes exhaling the odor of selfishness. And then you have on the other side, he says, the other household is a captivating, cordial, and enticing approach that warms your heart by the warmth of the heart that goes toward you. And again, I think it's a counterintuitive move to speak about the host approaching the guest. So the host approaches the guest with an open heart and with a warmth that entices a guest to take advantage of this hospitality. And he writes, between these two households lies the broad difference of whether the spirit of hospitality is upon us or whether we do not count with this holy ordinance of God. So hospitality both as a spirit, We can have the spirit of hospitality, but hospitality also as a law, as an ordinance of God, something that we're required to do. In these three quotes, I think we see the three elements of the Christian tradition of hospitality that I've written down on the page there for you. And we'll come back to these throughout. First, that the person who asks for welcome or hospitality should be seen and treated as if they were Christ, which is such a mind-blowing thing to imagine actually doing. It's one thing to say it. And the second is that one of the most compelling reasons to engage in hospitality is that each person contains the image of God in them, and that we share that image of God. We are like them in that way. And third, that hospitality sits in opposition to self-sufficiency. So hospitality is a sharing of life. It's not just something we do for someone else. Hospitality is a sharing of life and a sharing of God's gifts in a mutually dependent relationship. So we'll come back to these as we go through, but I wonder, and this is kind of the basis of what we want to talk about now in terms of contemporary connotations, I wonder if we've lost this sense of the importance of hospitality in Christian community, and also the call of hospitality for our whole lives, not just for our households or for our Sunday mornings, but hospitality as a way of life. Already in the 16th century, John Calvin was worried about it. He talked about inns being the end of the demise of hospitality because people were strangers instead of being hosted by the Christian community, were paying to be hosted by someone. And he says that we've lost the ancient hospitality that's celebrated in our history. Let's jump ahead now, though, to the 21st century, come to today. And think about what hospitality means in Australian, or actually this is a really diverse group, so South African, Dutch, Indonesian, Canadian, Kiwi, Australian, Australians, you can be included too. Yeah. What does hospitality in our culture look like? What does our surrounding culture assume hospitality is? And indulge me, if you will, with a game of word association. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of hospitality? What? A barbecue. Yeah, barbecue. That's right, a barbie. And food, yeah. Coffee after the service often. Yeah. Good or bad sometimes. An open heart. Okay. Yeah. People. Okay. Generosity. What's that? Messy. Yeah, I'll tell you a story later about messy hospitality. And a welcome. Yeah, that's good. I think that a lot of what we're saying here is really inflected by our Christian understanding of hospitality, which is wonderful. When I think about moments or stories of hospitality in my own life, I think perhaps of the dinner party that I had the other day with friends, and they came over and I brought out the most lavish of dinners, and we sat and we ate together and we maybe played a board game. This must have happened more than 3 years ago. Since Mala's come, we don't do this as often. But this hosting of friends where we enjoy each other's company. Or I might think about the time that I went to a restaurant recently in the hospitality industry, right? And the hostess at the front didn't greet me for a long time, and then the food was late and it was cold, and at the end maybe I insisted that I wasn't going to pay for this hospitality because it wasn't worth it, or I'm not coming back, I'm not giving my money again to this kind of hospitality because it's not worth it. Or I might think about kind friends who put up with me while I was vacationing in their city, and I reciprocate and say, next time you're in my city, come and stay with me and I'll give you that same hospitality. I think that hospitality in its current usage, particularly outside of the church, but probably inside the church as well, has a lot to do with these two kinds of hosting. The hosting of, the private hosting of close friends and family who we enjoy, people we enjoy or people who we want to know. Or payment for public hosting services, like hotels. It's an industry. Yet hospitality is supposed to be a way of life for the Christian community. It's a duty. It's a spirit, it's all these things, right? And it's not an optional self-serving activity. I think what's missing is a third category for hospitality, and that's the hosting of the stranger. In a call to conscience, which was a statement on refugees from faith communities of Canada, and faith communities, it was Christian faith communities, the only explicit reference to the common faith of all the people who signed on had to do with this welcoming the stranger, this concept of welcoming the stranger. They wrote, "A people who have been shaped by the biblical tradition, we are called to welcome the stranger as we would welcome God in our midst." So this phrase, especially for refugee activists in Canada and around the world, is the base common denominator for churches that disagree on all sorts of other theology. They know that and can agree that hospitality is part of the Christian tradition. But I'm not sure that this third category really exists in much strength in our culture, and I was trying to think of examples of where hosting the stranger occurs in our culture. I thought I'd open that up to you as well. Can you think of places in our culture where hosting the stranger happens regularly? Someone you don't know. The Salvation Army, in what area? Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So perhaps some of the charity organizations that give homes to homeless people. Yeah. Yeah, wow. So having your actual family home be a place of complete open doors to the neighborhood. Yeah, that's a huge sacrifice, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, overseas students. But is it something that's paid for, or is that... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's a great example. So international students that you host kind of as an act of Christian hospitality. Yeah. And were you going to say something? Yep. Yep. Soup kitchens. Yeah. Those are really encouraging examples of places where hosting the stranger is still alive. And I think that a lot of that emerges from this long Christian tradition of believing in the importance of hosting the stranger. I think another example that I thought of was farm co-ops. I don't know if you have that here, where people can go and become part of a farm, and they just become part of the community. They farm together, they labor together, and that seems to me quite a mutual example of hosting the stranger. As we wonder about whether or not we're losing or we have lost some element of the prophetic nature of our hospitality, we might ask ourselves the additional question of what the limits of our hospitality are personally and in our churches. At what point is a person no longer welcome? And I'm not talking about church discipline here. I'm talking about a person finding that they no longer have someone to speak to after the church service, or someone finding at a certain point that they are no longer really integrated into the community, not feeling welcome. Who do we have trouble welcoming? Who is it hard to make conversation with, I suppose? At what point, and this is just not on Sunday mornings, but this is also in terms of our witness in culture, right? We can think about it more broadly. Who in our culture is not welcome? And are we making space for them in our lives and in our communities? So part of this broader witness of living a life of hospitality in contrast to our culture. If you look at the chart that's on the handout that I gave you, on the left-hand side, I've just written some of the things that I think characterize hospitality in contemporary culture. I think often hospitality is lavish generosity for a few. You think of dinner parties where you pull out all the stops. It's often for friends and family or people that we want to get to know. It's often talked about as a gift that some people have. So this woman has a gift in hospitality, therefore she'll put together the potlucks and do the dishes after church. Or is potluck? I don't think potluck is actually a word you use here. But it is? Okay, bringing a plate. Yeah. It's limited. Hospitality is limited by the host's desires. So they can set the limit of who they host, when they host, and when that hosting is finished. It comes with an expectation of reciprocation. So I've invited you over for dinner, if you don't invite me over for dinner within a certain amount of time, I think, well, I'm not inviting them over again. You know, it's obviously not, you know, it's, so it's an accept, it's expected that the person will reciprocate. And it's often thought about in terms of being an industry where hospitality can be bought. So what might prophetic hospitality look like for the church? We've already given some really great examples. And maybe first we should say, what do I mean by prophetic? Since that can have quite a number of, we could be working with that in quite a number of different ways. Two people that I'm kind of leaning on here and thinking about the word prophetic. The first is Abraham Heschel. And he talks about the prophet as being someone who has his eyes on culture and his ear to God. So he's speaking very specifically about the Old Testament prophets who are watching culture, they're listening to God and finding ways to speak into culture. And then also Walter Brueggemann, who defines a prophetic community, so that's a prophet, but together as a community, we become a prophetic community when we are a sub-community that nurtures, nourishes, and evokes a consciousness and perception alternative to the consciousness and perception of the dominant culture around it. So this is really similar to contrast community, which we've been talking about, nurturing a different kind of community, a different consciousness of who we are, different perception of what our calling is, and also trying to evoke in other people a different sense of who we are and what we're called to be. Nurturing that so that we can speak into culture in fresh ways. So back to hospitality. What's so prophetic about hospitality? I think the act of hospitality and welcoming, particularly for churches that are working with refugees, and this is the area that I've done the most study in, has its basis in a number of scripture passages which provide a sort of narrative context for the importance of hospitality. And two are used particularly often to back up claims that the church is called to be hospitable to displaced people. The first is Hebrews 13:2, and the second is Luke 17, the story of Zacchaeus. The first, so Hebrews 13:2, do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by so doing some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. And the allusion in the verse is to Genesis 18, of course, when Abraham and Sarah welcome three strangers. These strangers don't have any social status that they know of. They don't even know these people. There's no mutual relationships. But they invite them into their home and then find out these are actually messengers from God with a message. The logic then goes, if any person could be a messenger from God, every person should be welcomed and treated with the same kind of hospitality. In the Hebrew, it might seem bitsy to pull out one verse and speak of it with such and to apply it in such a big way, but the Hebrew text suggests, I think, that hospitality was a key activity of the newly established church. Even more than an activity, it was a core identity marker for them. Hospitality was who they were. They were a hospitable community. Christine Pohl writes that early Christian writers claimed that transcending social and ethnic differences by sharing meals, homes, and worship with persons of different backgrounds was a proof of the truth of the Christian faith. I don't know if you've experienced that before, that apologetic for the faith. Hospitality as an apologetic for the faith. But in grad school, I had that experience very distinctively of being in an environment where the church was seen primarily as a place of privilege and a place of oppression because of its history. And I could walk in on Sunday and see this congregation that had such diversity in it. There was somebody who was mentally ill, somebody who saw off the streets, somebody who is an immigrant from Liberia, somebody who is, I was going to say refugee from Holland, probably not at this point, an immigrant from Holland, a refugee from Liberia, to see Canadians and Canadian citizens and people of all types being drawn to the gospel, being drawn to the power of the gospel, and being drawn to Jesus. And that as a sort of a proof of the truth of the gospel, that that it's not a social club, that there's some truth that's being held on to there. Further, the early church to which Hebrews was written deliberately tried to show hospitality, of course, in ways that contrasted with their surrounding culture. And instead of hosting in order to create beneficial connections, with powerful people. They were focused on hosting those who couldn't host back. So it's that idea of not expecting reciprocity. One great example, this is also Mount Druitt. There was a counseling service in Mount Druitt, Salvation Army as well. So we're finding a lot of themes here. And they were wondering how the spirit of hospitality could be in their counseling services. And small as it sounds, they decided to go with the only the best will do for the people who are coming in with any number of struggles, down to the toilet paper. We're going to buy the best toilet paper for these people as a way of hosting well and dignifying the people who came in. You're not coming in only to have your problems solved. You are coming in as a human being, and we want to dignify you and provide you with the best that we can offer. A kind of hospitality that says, I see the image of God in each person, and what I would want, I want to provide another person with. So that's the first passage that's often talked about. And the second one is Luke 17, the story of Zacchaeus, the hated tax collector who gouged people he collected from. And we tell this story often to Mala. She loves it. She calls him Lucius. But one day he set out to find and listen to a man whose public teaching had been causing quite a stir in the region because he was short, and I always felt an affinity to him when I was little. He had to climb the tree to see Jesus, right? And Jesus comes, calls him by name, says, come down, show me the way to your house. And in the storybook that we have for Mala, it ends there. And I got so upset when I realized that that's where it ended, because I thought the best part is yet to come. It says Zacchaeus welcomed him gladly. Jesus approaches and asks for hospitality. Zacchaeus says, yeah, I'll host you, welcomes him gladly into his home, and then somehow, over the course of this conversation, decides to give back times four what he had taken from people and half of what he owned to the poor. Some sort of radical change that happens in this encounter with Jesus, in his own hosting of Jesus. And what's interesting about this is that Jesus is guest, but he also becomes host in this moment. So Lauren Belisky, who's a member of Kinbrace, which is a transitional and communal living house for asylum claimants in Vancouver, interprets the story this way. Jesus turns hospitality on its head. He invites himself as guest, but subversively becomes the true host, welcoming Zacchaeus into a place where his identity is renewed and secured, a son of Abraham. And Christine Pohl elaborates on the same point, writing that the intermingling of guest and host roles in the person of Jesus is part of what makes the story of hospitality so compelling for Christians. Jesus welcomes, but he needs welcome all through his life, which is a really interesting place from which to do ministry. He welcomes, but he needs welcome. And Jesus requires then that his followers also depend on and provide hospitality. It's this sense of hospitality as mutual and shared dependence. Hospitality is in opposition to self-sufficiency, we see here again. In both of these passages, the act of hospitality, I think, is a radical equalizer as well. In both cases, the person hosting is a powerful person who offers no strings attached welcome. And somehow, in the act of hospitality, the person hosted becomes the host, and the original host finds themselves changed. The guest becomes the host's host. Think of how this might work itself out in your church. Imagine what happens when the person we invite into our home or our church or our country puts the dishes back in the wrong place, so to speak, or changes our routine, stomps up the aisle halfway through the service. It's hard to stay civil with family members or friends, let alone strangers in those moments. I think my dad will remember this story well. We had a fellow with a different sense of what private ownership meant come to live with us for a while. He's from Chile. And one day we came back to find that the wires on the back of our stereo system had all been cut and taken downstairs to the basement where he stayed, and set up so that he could have surround sound in his room. So we had nothing upstairs anymore, and he had surround sound downstairs. That really stretched our desire to be hospitable, and there might have even been a few votes for kicking him out. But it was, you know, it was an opportunity for conversation. It was an opportunity for growth for us, too, in thinking about how we hold on to things and to have a discussion about ownership and a way of finding a way to live graciously with each other, which was very hard in that moment. For contemporary culture, the host is the one with power. We have the power to eject this guy. We could have kicked him out in that moment. The power to decide the limits of hospitality. Yet Jesus, as a guest with Zacchaeus, turns everything upside down for Zacchaeus. He wasn't cutting the wires, granted. And he produces real growth in Zacchaeus as a host. Church-based refugee advocates extrapolate from this story the command to see the image of God in every guest and to offer self-sacrificial welcome to people regardless of their standing in broader culture, including whether or not they have legal status. More importantly, the message is that hospitality as a prophetic act goes two ways. As we've been saying, the power relationship set up in hosting must be equalized so that no one's disempowered by hospitality. If you have that experience of feeling disempowered by hospitality, realizing that there's the expectation that you don't have anything to offer, and actually finding hospitality is a really disempowering, dehumanizing experience. I have that occasionally, not because of Australia generally, but when I came as an immigrant to Australia and not being known and realizing people wanted to give, but they didn't expect to receive anything from me, and realizing that that ability to give back is a part of what that mutual hospitality looks like. That's the power of hospitality. And we've talked about this being an opportunity for growth in the host as well, these moments of messy hospitality. And one of the places, one of the times when Mark and I experienced this kind of messy hospitality the most cleanly, also in Mount Druitt, we had a Bible study going in our house, and we had decided that we were going to try and find a Bible study model that worked for the people who were falling through the cracks for small groups. So we thought we need kids, families with kids, and particularly single moms, because they can't, you know, one parent can't stay behind with the kids and go. So we decided to try and create a Bible study that would be open to single moms with kids specifically. And the majority of the people who ended up coming and joining the Bible study weren't Christians. The kids were wild. We had them come into our house, and by the time they left, an hour and a half later, the house was absolutely in shambles. And I remember every week thinking, do I have the energy for this? Do I have the energy to welcome these people into my home? Do I have the energy to clean up afterwards? And do I have the energy to just work with their energy, you know? I think for us it was a real stretch in learning how to be hospitable. What was amazing is that quite a number of people in that Bible study came to Christ through the Bible study, and their walks with Christ became a huge encouragement to us in what we were doing. And so there's a mutuality there. But even deeper, there were moments of mutuality that really grew us as Christians. There was a woman named Dot who had a really... She had a difficult life, self-confessed, and she said she had had a couple husbands who hadn't been kind to her, and she had had two sons die, one of an overdose and one murdered, and her way of coping was mostly through gambling addiction, but also through other kinds of addiction. And she had had one experience we found out from other people. She had had one experience early on when she was a young mom, and her husband, she was pregnant, and her husband got another woman pregnant and then left her. So here she was pregnant, this other woman now pregnant and alone as well. And Dot, of course, struggled quite a bit with anger. But at a certain point, she became just convicted in the need to be generous and to create a loving relationship with this other woman. And she took all the stuff that she had collected for her own baby, took it and gave it to this woman who was more in need than she was. And... it's kind of bizarre to think about, but she became really close friends with this woman, and that woman eventually came to Christ. And for Mark and I, in our, you know, we think we're hosting a woman with a gambling addiction. We're hosting a woman. You know, you have all these categories in your mind, and at some point that switches for us when we realize the amount that she had to teach us about living generously, the amount that she had to teach us about being filled with the Spirit. And so I think that example stands out for me as a moment when I realized that my hospitality was actually an opportunity for my own growth, and it was mutual. It's a mutual experience. The other thing that I've written on the second side of the column is that Christian hospitality is remedial. And what I mean by that is that Christian hospitality is a way of fixing things that are broken in culture, particularly divisions in culture. So if you look at church history and some of the major texts that are cited in theologies of hospitality, you can go to Exodus 23 or Matthew 25, Luke 10, Luke 14, Romans 15. They show that Christian hospitality has always been partly remedial, counteracting the social stratification of the larger society by providing, and I really like this phrase, a more modest and equal welcome for all. And that's a quote from Christine Pohl again. This reminds me of the story of the banquet and people being called in off the streets, right? It's modest because you need to be modest in order to invite more people in. These are two specific stories, right? We can go back to the Old Testament and get even a richer concept of communal costly hospitality. We did a bit of that today, and I think we'll do a bit more later as well. In the biblical tradition, we have Abraham, who's recognized as the wanderer par excellence, the tent dweller. He's celebrated in Psalm 119. I am a stranger on this earth. I am a wandering Aramaean. And Jews have festivals to remind themselves that they are descended from a nomad who shared hospitality to strangers. And that's our heritage, too. If you're an immigrant or have immigrant roots, you'll be able to imagine quite clearly this need for mutual hospitality. I think that Mark, at some point, is going to go back to the Old Testament again and do some theological work unpacking this history of welcome and hospitality for the displaced. So I won't say much more about that now, but... we've also talked just really briefly this afternoon about Jesus exemplifying prophetic hospitality with Zacchaeus, but with prostitutes, with lepers, with blind, with the poor. He welcomed and was welcomed by strangers. And his example, I think, as well as the whole narrative of the Bible, is a serious challenge to our anemic understanding of hospitality. And I say anemic, I think anemic is a really appropriate word there. I was diagnosed with anemia last year, and the low energy, the inability to look out for other people because you just don't have it in you. I think the hospitality that's anemic is kind of, I think that's a good way to describe most of our hospitality. Nietzsche wrote about Christians, they would have to sing better songs for me to learn to have faith in their Redeemer, and his disciples would have to look more redeemed. His disciples don't have to look more like me or like our culture. They have to look more like Jesus. And if we think about Jesus living a life of hospitality, sharing hospitality, that's one way I think that the church can look more redeemed. So just to summarize, on the right hand of that column, prophetic Christian hospitality, and I'm not offering this as a final word, but just one way to think about Christian hospitality. It's modest generosity for all. It's, yes, for friends, family, but it's also for strangers. It's a core identity marker of Christian disciples. It's an act of self-sacrifice, but not without the expectation of, and without the expectation of reciprocity. And even as an act of self-sacrifice, it's not disempowering. It's mutual. It's a way of life, and it's remedial. So that's just kind of a start thinking about how hospitality could look be prophetic in our community. So what does this kind of hospitality look like for a church community specifically? I was part of a church a number of years ago that it was a CRC church as well. They hired an outreach coordinator. And this outreach coordinator came from outside, actually a bit of a stranger, too. And one of the first things that he did was to scan the neighborhood and say, who's in our neighborhood? Who do we want to reach? Who can we reach? Who's here? What are the needs in our neighborhood? How can we meet them? And what they discovered was high populations of mentally ill people and a growing number of refugees. That's who's in our neighborhood. We had no idea. Those people were in our neighborhoods. The houses look the same as any other, right? And so then a committee brought the plan to the church to form ministries based on these needs in the neighborhood, find ways to reach out to people who are mentally ill, find ways to reach out to refugees. And what's really interesting and maybe surprising is that the church really resisted these suggestions. And there was a real resistance based on the fact that this might deplete our resources or our energy, that this wasn't actually going to build our church in numbers if it just became a service to the neighborhood. And, yeah, we might drain our resources, we might actually decrease our capacity as a church. But the committee and the leadership really persisted with this vision, and eventually a number of initiatives went forward, one of which, and I think the most radical of which, was hiring a mental health coordinator for the church. And there wasn't a large number of mentally ill people within our church. There were some, so that wouldn't have warranted hiring a mental health coordinator. But her job was to find ways to make space in our church for people who were mentally ill. That was what her task was. So she was teaching us. She had sessions after church teaching us about what it was like to be mentally ill and what barriers would be faced in coming and joining our church. So ways of being hospitable to people who didn't fit the mold in our church. And she also started hosting things that were not related to our church services. So having community meals where people learned how to cook certain things and then could take some of the food home, because that was one of the issues that they faced, was not having the resources or the capacity to cook for themselves. So some of these ways of really practically serving the people in the neighborhood. And then in terms of refugees, there were quite a number of refugee families who started coming to our church, and there was a link created between the Settlement and Integration Services Organization in our city and our church. And that organization had been quite suspicious of churches being involved in any way in what they were doing, because they thought there's always strings attached with the Christian community. They're going to want to, you know, they're going to want to throw something in there that we're not happy with. And when they found out that this was offered as a gift, we want to offer what we can contribute. It's a part of our living out our hospitality. Some of that suspicion decreased. I don't know if it disappeared altogether, but decreased, and we were able to create some really good links there. This was a move of prophetic hospitality, I think, these two things. And here we see like this welcoming without expectation of reciprocity. So welcoming mentally ill people without expecting that they're necessarily going to start coming to our church services, and being okay with that, because it's what we're doing as a community and sharing life with them. Being culturally remedial, our church actually became quite a hub for people who were mentally ill, because there weren't hubs for them elsewhere. And so there were a lot that just came to the services because it was a place they could come. And because they were there, they were hearing the gospel. And it wasn't for fellow Christians only, like I said. It was also just for people in the neighborhood, the stranger in the neighborhood. What's interesting is that it didn't deplete resources, and it actually increased capacity in the church. People started coming because they were attracted to this vision. People started becoming Christians because they were attracted to this vision. And people wanted to join in this work. So this act of prophetic hospitality that seemed like a self-sacrifice actually was something that built the church and increased its capacity. If I look at conversations about refugees at a national or cultural level, I think I often see the first column being exercised. The self-interest of citizens is really often prioritized over the needs of people that are seeking hospitality. And often it's because of fear about the dilution of wealth, or the dilution of culture, or gradual changing of culture. And I think these things really cause us to lose sight of strangers as Christ, strangers as made in God's image. And there are tons of things to be said about this. But maybe I'll just offer one thought, which is that I think it's just so important that in engaging these debates as Christians, that we lead with the desire to welcome and offer costly hospitality. So the sovereign nation state, this political entity, is quite a beast, and it's got its history, and there's a lot to be talked about. It's complicated. Borders are complicated. There are a lot of really intense, complicated questions to be discussed in terms of refugees and asylum claimants. But we very rarely lead with that spirit of welcome and generosity, a desire to host. And more often than generous, we're fearful, or we feel insecure, to go back to that first quote. We feel insecure, or we're tired of visitors. The conversation almost always comes out of this place of self-interest. And if hospitality is a core marker for us, not just a thing that we do on Sunday, but if it's actually a thing that marks who we are as a people, I think it's got to spill over into this conversation as well. Debate the hard questions, yes, but begin with a desire to welcome and the willingness to sacrifice as well for hospitality. Jacques Derrida has this interesting word that he's a neologism that he's come up with. It's called hospitality. He's bringing together hostility and hospitality. I don't know if you've heard that before. But the idea is that whenever you host and offer hospitality, you are also inviting hostility. And that you just, that's the risk you take when you host. And that you have to find ways to be strong enough for that, to accept people's hostility, to deal with that, and to create peace. So he actually has a really negative impression of Christian hospitality. And I kind of dealt with that a bit in my dissertation, pushed back against that, saying I think that actually the Christian tradition is really strong in this area, and that especially looking at the person of Christ and how he lived, that actually is pretty accurate. Inviting hospitality, also inviting hostility, and being secure enough, strong enough in the faith, the beauty of the faith that we hold, to be okay with that. Refugees are a kind of ultimate stranger, aren't they? Culturally, ethnically, linguistically, legally, in all sorts of ways, challenging our commitment to hospitality at a national and a cultural level. In Canada, and I don't know about Australia, refugee claimants, even when they're recognized and accepted as refugee claimants, so they are legitimately refugees according to the law, if they get into any sort of trouble with the law, often instead of going through the court systems, they're deported. Which doesn't seem right. That certain people, even when they've been resettled and invited to stay, they're being invited to be hosted, they remain a sort of second-class citizen, have to watch themselves more than the rest of us, so to speak, and aren't given the benefit of the doubt as we are going through the court system. Mark mentioned watching Four Corners, and I watched that with him as well. It reminded me of the dehumanizing response of public policy in Australia, as in Canada, as in many first world countries, to strangers seeking hospitality. And I think one of the barriers that we face is this not remembering the humanity of refugees, not remembering the image of God in every person. Because of the dehumanizing language of the debate itself. So I don't know if you've paid any attention to the kind of language that's used, but when I was here, it was the same here as it is in Canada, talking about refugees as natural disasters rather than human beings. So waves hitting our shore, waves of people hitting our shore, as if they're a tsunami that we have to shore up against. And the actual language that we use doesn't draw on this conviction that every person is Christ. And every person is made in God's image. One example of a really, I think this tradition of Christian hospitality and the Imago Dei is actually one beautiful way that we can contribute to the conversation. Wherever we fall in terms of, what kind of limitations we would want to set up. One example of a really creative response that I read in Australia was written by, or researched by Aaron Wilson and published in a Canadian Refugee Journal, actually. And she writes about the role of Christian organizations in Australia And this is one of their, just a really creative way of offering hospitality. And she uses the language of, she talks about the theology of hospitality as being the basis of this, of offering extended community care as an alternative to detention. Have you heard of that project? Yeah. And I don't know actually what happened to that project. That was in 2010, and I know that a lot has changed since then. But the idea was that there was an experiment in partnership with the government where churches offered to take families into their community and be responsible for them. So, like, we will be responsible for this family, make sure they go through the system, etc., so that they don't have to be detained offshore or elsewhere. And that, to me, is just a really creative and wonderful way of bringing the Christian tradition of hospitality into this debate. I was really excited to read about that and then thought, I don't know what's happened since. I know that the offshore detention centers have been reopened in the last year and a half, so I actually don't know what happened to this project. But, just one example of a way of being a faithful witness in this area. And a costly witness as well. I just want to finish by asking the question of how to nurture this sense of being a prophetically hospitable community. And feel free to tune out. It's been a long day, so I'm aware there's just a few more minutes. But and this stuff is a little bit heavier again. But Walter Brueggemann, I want to come back to him and his idea of a prophetic community. He gives us four ways in which a prophetic community becomes and stays a prophetic community. And there's probably a lot more to be said, but I think these are four good starting points. The first is a prophetic community is likely to be one in which there is a long and available memory that sinks the present generation deep into an identifiable past that's available in song and story. So a prophetic community, the church, keeps a memory, a long and available memory for history, for what's happened in history, and does it through songs and through the stories that we tell. Israel learned to do this in its festivals, right? How are we reminding ourselves of our own identity as those who have received and so must give? Do we have songs that talk about this kind of thing? Do we have the stories that we tell that are well known, that remind us of this? And are we remembering also not just our biblical heritage and that history, but also the history of our culture, of traumatic displacement in Australia, from Holland, in Canada, in South Africa, and elsewhere, as a way of retaining compassion today? Remembering those stories, singing about those stories. The second is, in a prophetic community, you're likely to have an available and expressed sense of pain that is owned and recited as a real social fact, that is visibly acknowledged in a public way, and that is understood as unbearable for the long term. So a sense of dis-ease with what is wrong in the world and a willingness to express that as pain in our community. I think it's harder to do that when our community does not include the people for whom this pain is happening. I know there's one community that when Bill C-31 came out, Mark talked about that earlier in his talk, they decided to have a public lament, create some sort of public lament about what was going on. And largely that came about because there were a huge number of refugees, Christian refugees, that were in their congregation and were going to be affected by it. And so for them, it was easier to think about expressing that pain, which is, again, another reason for thinking about, does our church reflect the full diversity of people in our neighborhood? And are we aligned with people who feel this kind of marginalizing pain? So an available and expressed sense of pain. The public lament that this church did was they had... anybody could come up to the front and light a candle and then put... We just began detention centers. So this is kind of a new thing in Canada. So jailing families as soon as they reach the shore, our shore or our border. So lighting a little candle and putting it into a cage to represent someone for whom we're lamenting, someone in detention for whom we're lamenting. And then writing on a piece of paper a text from the Bible that we thought spoke to the issue. And then standing in front of a camera, or a video camera, and just holding it up and looking into the camera, and then walking away. And then they created a whole video out of this that was a public lament. And they fast-forwarded everything, so it happened quickly. And you could see this flashes of Bible verses, candles being lit, Bible verses, candles being lit, and all these different faces of people who were lamenting publicly with refugees. And then they put it online so that anybody could see, our church is lamenting publicly. We have a sense of pain over this on behalf of people who are suffering. We talked about public celebration. It's a lot more fun to think about, but this is the other side of the coin, right? The third is an active practice of hope. A community that knows about promises that are yet to be kept. We know the kingdom is still coming. We know it's not going to happen. All the lamenting in the world, all the action in the world isn't going to accomplish it. We know that. And so finding ways to express the hope that we have that one day it will be better. One day Christ will come back and our community will be renewed. The world will be renewed. Knows about promises yet to be kept and promises that stand in judgment on the present. And then the fourth one, a prophetic community is likely to be one in which there's an effective mode of discourse that's cherished across the generations, that's taken as distinctive, and that is richly coded in ways that only insiders can know. And here, I think, is where this concept of hospitality and the Imago Dei comes in, that these are very distinctive Christian discourses, powerful theological concepts and practices, traditions that that are unique in our culture. And so a prophetic sub-community will nurture the use of these discourses, thinking about what it means to be hospitable and using that language, using the language that we find in the Bible about this as we enter into debates. And I think maybe I'll end there. But just return to that first quote and then we'll finish with that. That welcome is one of the signs that a community is alive. To invite others to live with us is a sign that we aren't afraid, that we have a treasure of truth and of peace to share. A community which refuses to welcome, whether through fear, weariness, insecurity, a desire to cling to comfort, or just because it's fed up with visitors, is dying spiritually. So I hope this has been an encouragement to you in thinking about your church community and broader community, your families, about how to revitalize that sense of hospitality as a way of life. Thank you.